Hi, and welcome back to the Beauty of Conflict podcast. We know you're busy, and we want to make it easy for you to understand how conflict may likely be showing up in a way that's impacting your team negatively. We've recorded the first three chapters of our book for you to listen to for free. Get your free audio sample at thriveinc.com/free sample. That's thriveinc.com/freesample. Hi there, this is Chris Marie Campbell. And today we have a special guest, Judd Brewer, MD, PhD, or Dr. Judd for short, is a thought leader in the field of habit change and the science of self-mastery. Having more than 20 years of experience with mindfulness training with his scientific research therein, Dr. Judd is the Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center, an associate professor in psychiatry at the School of Medicine at Brown University, as well as chief medical officer at ShareCare and a research affiliate at MIT. Very busy man. Previously, he held research and teaching positions at Yale University and the University of Massachusetts Center for Mindfulness. You are the mindfulness guru we get to interview today. I'm so excited. Welcome, Dr. Judd.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what even got you interested in this field of study, which you've done so much research in?
Well, it was my own suffering, actually. I was pretty stressed out at the beginning of medical school. And first day of medical school, I started meditating and realized that, wow, this was really helpful for me.
I love it.
Yeah. And I spent 8 years going through my MD PhD program. I was actually studying, doing molecular biology. And I decided to shift my entire career from that type of research to studying mindfulness when I finished residency, because it really resonated with me. And there really wasn't very much research going on at the time.
Wow. I love that. I have to say, our beauty of conflict started with my own suffering and terror in conflict. So I could really relate to that as a personal motivator to engage in your work. So at the time, was mindfulness meditation? What I'd love for you to delineate for our listeners, for me, is we've got meditation, we've got self-awareness, mindfulness. There's probably other things that I'm not even mentioning. Can you delineate the nuances between each of those?
I'd be happy to. I think of mindfulness as this large sphere, and meditation is kind of a smaller circle within that larger Venn diagram, let's say, of mindfulness. And we can think of mindfulness, there are lots of different definitions, but pragmatically speaking, it's about two elements. One is awareness, so paying attention to whatever's happening, but also bringing this curious attitude to that moment. So we can be paying attention to something and judging it like, oh, that sucks, or that's great. Or we can be really curious, like, oh, what is this? Which actually helps us clear the mind of our preconceived notions and really meet the moment fresh.
Yeah, I love that. Because I think one of the things in my own personal journey is when I'm feeling something, I immediately go, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this, and then want to change it, which just binds me up in the whole thing and making it harder to shift anything. So
I was just going to say that, and that's what mindfulness and curiosity in particular can really help with that. It's whether somebody's having a craving or whether somebody's bound up in worry. I entitled my book Unwinding Anxiety because anxiety is that total wound up quality of experience. And it's really hard to unwind, especially when it's a habit.
Yeah, that's true. So you do, in your work, I imagine, the habit piece, address the neuroplasticity of the brain and self-changing your own neuroplasticity. Is that true? Or can you give some frame on how you work with people in changing their habit?
Yes. Well, clinically, I work with patients. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, so work with folks with addictions and also work with a lot of people with anxiety, work with a lot of people who have binge eating or overeating. And what I found clinically was that I was actually really struggling to help my patients with just the general prescriptions. So for example, with anxiety, there's this term called number needed to treat. So like it gives a rough and dirty of how many people you need to give a medication to or a treatment to before one person benefits. And with anxiety treatment, it's 5.2. So about 1 in 5 people shows a significant reduction in symptoms of anxiety when they're given gold standard treatment. And so I'm basically playing the medication lottery in terms of like, I don't know who's going to benefit of the next five patients I treat and then what to do with the other four. So I really started looking at the literature to see what I was missing, what class I had slept through in medical school or something like that. And I found out that anxiety actually can be driven like a habit, which I don't remember, I didn't learn, and it isn't typically taught in medical school. And that premise was just blew my mind because I've been studying habit change. And I'd been, for example, I'd done some early studies with smoking cessation where we took this radical approach of instead of telling people to stop smoking, because everybody knows that they should stop smoking, told people to go ahead and smoke, but pay attention as they smoked. And I started doing this first clinically. And the premise was that if we can tap into our brain's reward system, the way that works is that our brains are going to keep doing things that are rewarding and they're going to stop doing things that are not rewarding. The process is called reward-based learning or reinforcement learning. And so I started playing with this in my clinic where I would have my patients really pay attention when they smoke cigarettes. And they started realizing that cigarettes taste like crap. And a lot of them, they would come back after I'd give them the homework to go smoke mindfully. They come back and they go, how did I not see this before? I had one guy who'd been smoking 40 years. And we calculated the number of times he had reinforced that habit, which was roughly 300,000 times. And he came back and he's like, how did I not notice that this thing is so crappy? And the reason that's so important is because that's actually tapping into our brain's reward system, the strength of our brain. So when we see that something's not very rewarding, we're going to become disenchanted with it, and it's going to be much easier to break that habit if it's an unhealthy one. So we actually did a study, a randomized controlled trial in my lab. I was at Yale at the time. And we found that we got five times the quit rates of gold standard treatment with smoking cessation, right? By doing these mindfulness practices. So long story short, what I do is bring awareness in. So for example, we've even developed digital therapeutics like app-based mindfulness training programs and studied those. So for example, we have one called Eat Right Now, which helps people pay attention as they eat, whether they're overeating or stress eating or emotionally eating. And this is even now recognized by the CDC as a diabetes prevention program because it can help people, you know, so well. But the idea is to, if you pay attention when you overeat, you see that it actually doesn't feel that great. And so in one study we just published last year, maybe 2 years ago, we found that it only takes 10 to 15 times of somebody paying attention as they overeat for that reward value to drop below zero and for them to start shifting that behavior. So there's the power of neuroplasticity, right? And all that requires is one simple ingredient, which is awareness. Yeah. So in one other example, we have this app called Unwinding Anxiety that we just did a randomized controlled trial with. We got a 67% reduction in anxiety by targeting that reinforcement learning mechanism. And it only within 2 months, people with generalized anxiety disorder are dropping this by 67%. That number needed to treat that I mentioned earlier, it was 1.6. Wow. So yeah. Yeah. So the idea is if we can really understand these mechanisms, right? And it's reinforcement learning for a lot, almost every habit is reinforced through the same reward-based learning mechanism. We can target that with awareness. And if something is unrewarding by paying attention to the smoking or overeating or worrying, that reward value drops. And then it makes it much easier to shift out of that behavior.
I love it. So let me just see if I can reflect back what I'm hearing you say. Yeah. It's so easy with, like, I love what you're doing is having people go ahead and smoke, have people go ahead and overeat, even be anxious, but in that moment of anxiety, really start to notice what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, the thoughts I'm telling myself, the body constrictions. And you said 10 to 15, they only have to do that 10 to 15 times before they start to actually shift their reward system. Is that true?
Yeah, that reward value dropped below zero in 10 to 15 times, not just for it to start, but for it to nosedive below zero.
Wow. This is true in all that was smoking, but is that true also in the overeating and the anxiety?
So that was in our Eat Right Now study with our eating app. With smoking, it's interesting because it doesn't drop as quickly. And I think it's because, so my hypothesis is that most people who smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, they're reinforcing that habit loop 20 times a day. With eating, you can't generally don't overeat 20 times a day. Yeah. So So it can take a little bit longer for these more entrenched habits where somebody has reinforced this 300,000 times. It can take a little bit longer, but it doesn't have to. For some people, it can happen pretty quickly. If they really pay attention and see how disgusting a cigarette is, you know, somebody commented, they said, all the cigarettes I smoked today were disgusting. Like literally, that was their comment.
I love it.
So if somebody sees that pretty quickly, they can change that habit pretty quickly as well.
Okay, Dr. Jed, help me with sugar, because sugar sure tastes good when I'm doing it. I mean, and I don't have to overeat it. I can just have a piece of cake, but I shouldn't be having the piece of cake. So does it work with that sort of?
It does. And I think here we can look at, so awareness isn't going to make food taste bad. In fact, we might enjoy it even more.
Right.
But what it can help us do is see what it is. So for example, are we eating cake because it's dessert, because we're hungry, because we're stressed, because we're bored? We can map out what it is that's driving us to eat. So for example, if we're eating because we're bored, we can then ask ourselves, okay, what did I get from that? And feel into our direct experience, right? And so, okay, it might have distracted me for a little bit, but now the boredom comes back.
I'm still bored.
Yeah, am I going to eat another piece of cake and then another? And so here we can start to, I call this the pleasure plateau. We can start to ask ourselves with each bite even. So with each bite of cake, we can ask ourselves, is this better than, worse than, or the same as the last bite? Because our brain is going to say, okay, I like sugar, but well, you know, enough is enough. And we can start to map out that pleasure plateau pretty quickly before we go over that cliff of overindulgence. So it's not going to make cake taste bad. It's going to help us check in and see, do I really need this? And often when people are stressed out and they see that the cake isn't actually helping their stress, but even making them more stressed because like, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that cake. Then they can step back and ask, what do I need instead of feeding that want? Because it's like often we're like, oh, we feed the want. But in fact, we can step back and ask and take care of our needs instead of indulging those wants.
I like that. So it sounds like, and there's, I would love maybe, because this is probably what you do, I'm going to guess, in your Eat Right Now app. There's different dimensions that you're helping somebody like me zoom in and notice with my awareness and curiosity. And it sounds like one, it's, and I'm just guessing, so you can actually tell us, but like what's going on, but there's also my motivation and then the, what happens after. So can you walk us through that process as you are coaching me to on the cake thing?
Let's just So I often start with just a tiny bit of theory to help people kind of orient around why we're doing something. So it's called reward-based learning for a reason, because if something's rewarding, we're going to keep doing it. If it's not rewarding, we're going to stop doing it, or at least become more disenchanted with it. So that's basically the only theory we need to know. So we need to identify the behavior, and we need to identify what the result of the behavior is. And so if somebody, let's say, is overeating, I have them pay attention as they eat and feel into their body as they eat. How's it taste? How's it feel? Or if they're smoking a cigarette, what's it taste like? How's that smoke feel going into their lungs? What's it smell like coming out of their mouth? Yeah. And so they can really see the direct results. It's really important to keep this embodied, right? So because our bodies, I think of it this way, our bodies are much wiser than our thinking brains, right? And so we've got to listen to the body because the body's going to tell us everything. We can try to think our way out of, oh, I shouldn't smoke. I shouldn't eat the second piece of cake or whatever. If that worked, my psychiatric practice would be much easier, right? Because I would just tell my patients, we'll stop doing that. And then they would stop, right? So that's basically what I do is I say, okay, just identify what you're doing, drop into your direct experience and pay attention as you do it. And then ask this simple question, what am I getting from this, right? What? Feel into your direct experience. Asking that question, what am I getting from this?
What am I getting from this? And while it's happening, right?
Yeah, ideally. They can also do it afterwards because often people get stuck in this habit or they're on autopilot and they're not paying attention. But afterwards, when they're feeling guilty and they're feeling bloated or they're feeling the sugar hangover or whatever, then they can say, wow, what did I get from that? Well, I'm getting the results of it right now and they're not great.
Right. I love it. And also, oh, I want another one. Let me just keep eating. Like, oh, but imagine I'm not a chip fan. Susan's the chip fan, but the same thing, like you go through a whole bag or half a bag or whatever.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I had a patient who came in and she used to eat it was an entire bag, not a small snack bag, but like an entire bag of potato chips every night. And she would do this as part of her bond. She would bond with her daughter. They'd watch a television show at night. And she would basically mindlessly eat these potato chips. So I said, okay, go and eat the potato chips, but just pay attention as you do. Guess how many potato chips it took for her to stop it, like, I've had enough, hit her pleasure plateau.
I have no idea, like five?
Yeah, close. It was two. So I call her my two potato chip lady because there was enough salt in those. I mean, God, you really pay attention to potato chips. They are pretty salty.
Yes. Exactly.
It's like half a gallon of water per potato chip to keep yourself hydrated.
Right.
So it really only took her paying attention, and she would eat two potato chips, and then she'd save a bunch of money because she wouldn't be eating an entire bag of potato chips every night.
Well, probably also if she had any weight issues, that was a big impact to the weight issue. There's the Slow Diet is a book that, and a school of thought just to slow down the eating. It was more, I think he studied people in Europe who are having fun while they eat, like versus our Big Macs and fries and on the run sort of.
Fast food, right.
Yes. But you know, what I find it's even with, like I could have used this when I was having my burger and fries that were very salty, but I ate them all because I was chatting and talking. And so then it's harder for me to pay attention to what's happening on the inside.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have people, how do you help people through tug of war?
Yeah. Social eating is a major issue, like you're highlighting. So, and many of us spend so much of our time eating with other people. It's a very social occasion. So what I'll have people do is there are a couple of different ways that they can play with this. One is to, when they take a bite of food, to make sure they put down their fork or their spoon while they're chewing. Just as that one little piece to slow things down a little bit.
Yeah.
Another is when there's a lull in conversation, and there always is one, that's the time to say, okay, I'm going to pay attention for a few bites and eat this and pay attention as I eat. Another is to say, this wacky doctor, Dr. Judd, suggested that I pay attention while I eat because I might actually enjoy my food and not overindulge. I'm going to try this out. And so I'm going to pay a little more attention to my eating for a few minutes during the conversation or something like that, just to give everybody else some warning and also invite them to pay attention as they eat as well. It can be a great fun thing where it's like, we're a curiosity exercise. Like, what do you notice about your food? And go around the table. Like, what do you notice? What do you notice? What do you? And it actually helps to bring out that natural curiosity, but also brings it out as a social contagion, because curiosity is, I love it because it's super contagious in a good way.
I love that it's, we talk about curiosity and vulnerability and conflict, like being curious about what's happening. And I love that it's a social contagion though. Like other people are like, oh, what is that? I could get curious.
Yeah.
And I do think dinner time must be interesting at your house when you're really doing mindful eating.
Yes. Let's just say it's not dull and we're not watching television.
Right. Because that's another thing I think that clicks us into something outside of ourselves versus what's happening is our inner experience, the TV. Mm. Yeah. And puts me in a brain state. And somehow it must be. So even I would think, though, tell me where I'm wrong. You would have your coaching would be, well, try eating in front of the TV and see what you notice, like turning on your awareness.
More. Yes. Yeah. This is not about prohibiting ourselves from doing things. The best way to fail at something is to tell ourselves to do it, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you got to do that. Well, probably going to fail by trying to force ourselves.
Yeah.
So here it's about, I think of curiosity as a superpower. It's like, well, if you tend to eat something in front of television, great. Just see how much you can pay attention with each bite, right? Yeah. It's not to say don't do it, but like how much can you pay attention? Yes. And what's it like when you don't pay attention? And the thing is just now your stomach is a rock and you haven't even tasted the food.
Right. Yeah. Now I imagine people, have you done much with drinking? Not like with alcoholics necessarily, but people that are drinking more than they want to drink. And is it the same process? And what have been the results if you have?
Yeah, I've worked across the spectrum, and it's interesting with intoxicants like alcohol, it's harder to pay attention when you're intoxicated, right? Yeah, it's amazing how you can do the same thing with each sip. If somebody's sipping a beer or wine or even hard liquor, it's like how little is enough and what's the enjoyment there? Mm-hmm. And then where does it shift into just like, okay, got to have another one after this? And a lot of people find that it's like one drink says that got to have that next drink. And they see, why do I have to have that? I'm fine with one. And I actually feel better. I sleep better at night. And they start to notice all of the rewards that come from stepping out of the old. If somebody is fully intoxicated, I've done tons of folks who have alcohol use disorder, for example. It's hard when they're totally intoxicated to pay attention. So I have them pay attention afterwards. So typically the next morning doesn't go so well when they've had a bender. And so they can pay attention afterwards and ask, what did I get from that? Well, I feel hungover and I feel anxious and I feel this and that and the other. And then they can also notice on times, on days and nights when they haven't done that. So for example, I had a patient who, she was about 50 years of age when she finally quit drinking, but she'd been drinking. She was way out of control, disordered drinking for about 20 or 30 years. Yeah, she started in her 20s. And one thing that we explored was like on the days, on the mornings that you haven't had anything to drink the night before, pay attention to what that's like. And she started and she's like, wow, I feel so much better. And so every morning she would start reinforcing how and savoring those mornings. And then also savoring the moments like where she didn't get embarrassed with in front of her teenage kids the night before and all these other negative consequences that come with overindulgence. And she would see, wow, all of that stuff. She could see it clearly, how that stuff was just really not helping her and how great it felt to wake up in the morning fresh, to have a good relationship with her kids and all that. And all of that is what actually helped sustain her. She's now been sober 3 years.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she wakes up every morning and she checks in with herself. And like, how do I feel? I feel pretty good.
I love the what you're adding here for our listeners, this quality of savoring, which is a lot in the, like, I love Hardwired for Happiness, Rick Hansen's. If we just savor, this is one example when he was a nerd and the guys asked him for pizza and he's like, they're asking me for pizza. Like savoring that moment where I'm not being rejected, I'm actually being included. And like 5-10 seconds can really do a lot to probably turn on the reward center in your brain in that.
Absolutely. It doesn't take a lot of time.
That is great. That's so reassuring. I think sometimes people get really discouraged about changing habits. And like when you're saying 10 or 15 times to use the eat right now process of slowing down and that it really can shift. I'm definitely going to try it with my cake.
Let me know what you discovered.
Well, now let's talk about anxiety because that you did say it's that whole tangle. And I know I've done work, Unlearn Your Anxiety, Howard Schuberner, another person who talks about the whole doctor who talks about the whole learned pattern of anxiety. So help as if, because there's times I can go, fine, I'm not anxious. And then something comes up and I'm really anxious. A client doesn't like, something bad happens and I'm like, ah. So help us through modeling through that.
Yeah. Well, it's very much the same process as what we've talked about. The first thing to recognize is that anxiety can be driven like a habit. And so the typical sequence is something, some flavor of this, where the feeling of anxiety triggers the mental behavior of worrying or procrastinating or stress eating or whatever. And then we dive into the result. What do we get from the result? Well, the worry actually tends to feed back and make the anxiety worse. So it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't keep the family member safe. It doesn't do what we think it's supposed to be doing. It actually just making us more anxious. So that's the first step, is recognize whatever the loop is. The second step is to ask that same question. What am I getting from this, right? What am I getting from worrying? Nothing. So we become disenchanted with it. And then the third step is to bring in curiosity as a superpower. And when we feel anxious, we can either worry or we can get curious about what those feelings feel like. And instead of having to do something to make the anxiety go away, which is our typical habit, we can just simply be with the feelings of anxiety. And guess what? They'll go away on their own.
Love it. Yeah, I love it. Versus, okay, I got to get up. I got to do something. I've got to eat something. Yeah. So what I heard you say is one, recognize what is happening in the moment, that felt sense experience. And what am I getting? Then ask, what am I getting? Bring curiosity as superpower. Love that. Like, oh, this is interesting. And not making it wrong. Like then you become the curious observer to what is happening and just be with the increase your capacity. I think sometimes we don't have a capacity to be, we haven't learned the capacity to be with these uncomfortable feelings, which is why we're trying to get away from them.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. It's about building, mindfulness really helps us build distress tolerance. And life, as what is it, the Princess Bride, the prince says, I forget, what was his famous line? Life is suffering. And anybody tells you differently is trying to sell you something or something like that. The Wesley says that to the princess. So life, there is going to be distress in life. We can't avoid it. So better to be able to work with it than try to run away from it.
Yeah, that's right out of what we're talking about when we deal with conflict, because that's when, oh my gosh, you won't, maybe you don't like me. Maybe this is going to go bad. So people go into their reactive patterns. So we're changing their habits, helping them, that whole increasing the distress tolerance. Well, and is, I guess this process generally helps increase the distress tolerance, being aware and the curiosity.
Oh yeah. Curiosity, curiosity, curiosity. I mean, I keep saying it, but like nothing better than curiosity to help us with distress tolerance and build that distress tolerance.
And it must activate, I'm going to guess, you probably know, this is just a hunch, a different part of the brain than our analytical judging brain. Curiosity must live somewhere else because it does feel so different when I'm able to activate that.
Yes. Yeah. And there are two types of curiosity. One has been studied more than the other. One's called interest curiosity, and that's the one we've been talking about. The other is called deprivation curiosity, where when we don't know the answer to something, we're deprived of that information. So deprivation curiosity actually feels more closed down and contracted, kind of like anxiety does. Like,
oh my gosh.
And that seems to be associated with dopaminergic mechanisms. The interest curiosity I haven't seen anybody nail that down in the brain yet in terms of what's going on. But I'm pretty sure it's different. It certainly feels different.
Yeah.
And my guess is that it's going to activate different systems in the brain.
Yeah. We interviewed Jill Bolte Taylor, and she talks about the four characters of the brain. And I'm thinking it must be on the right side, this interest, curiosity, probably in the prefrontal cortex. That's my story. You can study it. Don't tell us the answer.
Who knows?
But because it does, it just feels so open and less in that piece.
Yeah.
I love it. So I'm trying to think of any other habits of other places. Have you ever done anything with habits around conflict? How people react in conflict?
Well, I think there are a lot of people have the habit of getting angry in conflict, and that's their go-to mechanism. I'm sure you've looked at this more than I have, but I've certainly worked with patients in that respect in helping them with their kind of their anger habits. And it's the same process. It's like, what do I get from anger? Versus we can compare that to curiosity. Right. It's a no-brainer in terms of which one's going to help.
Well, it's like, I really appreciate, well, one of the things with curiosity, when I recognized it was a habit, I'm like, I can change the people and I'm still doing the same thing. So it's creating this thing, this reaction over here. Yeah. I think it's tricky is there, they feel, it can feel so loud. Because it was learned so, for me at least, and many people learned so young, we didn't even have the awareness of a choice point of how we react in conflict.
Absolutely.
But it's probably still a habit that's probably, we probably learned to eat fast when we were young. All these things are just, so what other habits? Food, smoking, intoxications, anxiety? Are there other conflict I'm saying?
Social media. That's a big one these days.
Oh, where people go to their social media?
As a distraction, whether it's boredom or stress or anything.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. That's my go-to. I was saying, I forget who, that kids now don't even have a chance to be bored, which is really the spark of, can be the spark of creativity that like, well, let's make up a game sort of thing. Because the habit is to go right to social media or a device. And
let's just say it's a very different world.
Yeah. And do you work? So tell us more about, like, you have books, you have apps. Tell our listeners more about how they can try out your protocol.
Well, we have a bunch of free resources on my website. So that's probably the first place to go, which is just drjudd.com, drjudd.com. And if somebody likes reading books, I wrote a couple of books. One's called Unwinding Anxiety. One's called The Craving Mind. They can get more information on those on my website. And then these apps that I mentioned, they can also get information on the apps. The one for smoking is called Craving to Quit. The one for eating is called Eat Right Now. And then the one for anxiety is called Unwinding Anxiety. And people can also just search those on their app store, the Google Play store, and download them.
That's great. Now, can you just talk a little bit before we end on the whole idea of craving? Because that must feel like I have to do it when I have a craving. Can you talk about that dynamic? Or and how you work with it?
Yeah. So craving is really drive, this urge, this desire that can feel overwhelming. And often that idea, what we resist persists. And so cravings, somebody described it as the craving monster. The more you fight the craving monster, the bigger it gets, right? So the way to work with any craving is to pull an Aikido move on it. And instead of trying to resist it or fight it, we just invite it in. And so at first, it's like we have a craving for a cigarette. We talked about this, right? It's like pay attention as we indulge. What do we get from this? And then we can also start paying attention to the craving itself and get curious. Oh, what does this craving feel like? So for example, I had a patient who came to my office. I was working at the VA hospital at the time. And he came in and he said, "Dog, if I don't smoke, my head's going to explode." And of course, my habit at the time, I'd never seen chief complaint head exploding. So I wasn't sure how to deal with this. So my habit was to go to my whiteboard and start drawing. Okay, well, professor, we'll pull that. And so I started asking him to describe what head exploding and craving felt like, and then how intense it was getting. And so intensity was going up as he was describing tightness and tension and burning on all this. And then it peaked and it started to go down and his eyes got really big. And I asked him what happened. He said, "Well, I always smoke when it gets pretty high. I didn't realize I didn't have to smoke and it would go away."
Wow. So
there he discovered, perhaps for the first time, that he didn't have to indulge in his craving, that it was just these physical sensations that were going to come and go. His head was not going to explode. Never had a patient's head explode yet. And we get empowered that way. It's like, oh, these are sensations. They're not as bad as I thought. I can be with them. And they'll go away on their own.
I love it. And even in your story of having him, which he had the container of you to help be with these pieces and externalize what's happening. But even you noticing, hey, this is my habit. I'm going to go explain. Because you can start to notice how you're responding in so many different circumstances.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. Because I go to fixing. Fixing's a habit. People pleasing, habit. It can really, so how do you help somebody bring more mindfulness into the plethora of how, like, it's not just me, it's just my brain's habit. How do in every day?
Well, it starts with curiosity. The middle part is curiosity. The end is curiosity. It's really about just being curious, like, oh, and just knowing that we have this habit mechanism, let's call it, the habit loop mechanism in our brain. So if we know what it is, we know pretty straightforward, then we can start being on the lookout for it. Yeah. And then it's curiosity all the way through.
I love it. Well, you are delightful. It's right up what I'm working on for people that are dealing with conflict, but myself with anxiety. And so it's unwinding
anxiety. Yes.
Unwinding anxiety, eat right now.
And craving to quit is the smoke.
I love it. So that's how you can find out. And drjudd.com, J-U-D.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Delightful. Listeners, I know you can use these skills for many habits. And knowing that you don't have to just keep following your habits. They are not you. They're just your brain that keeps repeating. So thank you for being on, Dr. Judd.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks for joining us. We hope you found today's episode valuable. If you want to take some of what you've learned on today's episode to the next level, check out our new step-by-step, easy-to-use team kit to get your team from avoiding conflict to discovering the beauty in conflict.
Go to www.thriveinc.com/teamkit to learn more. That's www.thriveinc.com/teamkit.